And a cheerful good morning to everyone. This is Roy Porter in the NBC newsroom in New York, and the news is hot today. The Moscow conference is over, and General Marshall is on his way home by air. Palestine is ablaze with Jewish reprisals against the British, including bombings and alleged kidnappings. Henry Wallace is speaking out in Paris and has been denied the use of the Hollywood Bowl. Washington is all embroiled in more governmental disputes. A word from your announcer, then I'll be back with your world news roundup.
Both your government and private enterprise are doing everything possible to ease the critical housing problem through building as many homes and apartments as possible in the quickest possible time. Even so, it may be 2, 3, maybe 4 years before there's enough living space to take care of all Americans who need homes of their own. Meanwhile, we as individuals can do a lot to help those hardest hit by the lack of proper living quarters, the returned veteran, his wife, and children. If you have an unused guest room, a spacious attic, or an unused second story on a garage, why not turn it into a small apartment? FHA-insured loans are available to help ease the financial burden. Put unused space to work to beat the housing shortage, and notify your local Veterans Housing Center. And now, back to the World News Roundup.
Price cuts are becoming popular now in response to an appeal by President Truman. Newburyport, a town in Massachusetts, has set the pace with 10% off for almost everything. Now the movement is spreading throughout the country, but economic experts say that cutting retail prices is not just enough. The lop-off has to come from the wholesalers. Let's take a quick look at the entire price-cutting situation from all over the country with Clifton Utley in Chicago.
1,500 store owners, members of the Chicago Southside Merchants Association, today announced that beginning tomorrow morning, they'll cut all prices 10%. They thus become the second Chicago area group to copy the Newburyport price cut plan. Yesterday, the merchants of Franklin Park, a Chicago suburb, dropped prices 10%. Today, there are reports that the Newburyport plan is snowballing in stores all over the nation. Spring Valley, New York, has adopted the scheme. So has Brockton, Massachusetts. Ditto with various stores in Mississippi, Texas, Oklahoma, Michigan, Indiana, Iowa, and other states. But the thing to bear in mind is that thus far, the cuts are primarily on the retail level, and thus what is going on partakes of the nature of an inventory sale. There have been some price cuts by manufacturers and wholesalers, but not many. Shoes, soap, lumber, electric irons, and insulating materials have been cut at the producer or wholesale level at levels at some places. But even here, cuts have hardly been general. In the big basic industries, steel, foods, and the like, which underlie the larger part of our price structure, there just haven't been any cuts at wholesale or producer levels. Chicago packers say they simply can't cut prices. They're paying the farmer more for cattle than before. Other food processors make similar statements, and food prices during the present inflation have increased more than any other important cost of living item. Thus, unless the present stickiness of prices at wholesale and producer levels is broken, even 10,000 Newburyport plans throughout the country will not have much lasting effect. For come time to replenish inventories, retailers will have to repurchase at the old high levels. There is, of course, one qualification to all this. If present price cuts cause consumers to go on a buyer strike at points where cuts are not being made, well, then that could bring down prices generally, including wholesale and producer prices. It could do it rather quickly, too. But will it happen? This is Clifton Utley speaking from Chicago.
General Marshall is on his way home after a caviar and vodka banquet at the Kremlin. He has expressed his regret at the lack of progress at the Big Four conference, and he plans to give the U.S. a report on what happened as soon as he gets home. Here's Robert Magidoff in Moscow.
The diplomatic retreat from Moscow has begun. The first to go was Secretary Marshall and his delegation. Their five planes were seen off at 9 this morning by Deputy Foreign Minister Vyshinsky and the American, British, and Greek ambassadors. Secretary Marshall had a few subdued and patient words in his farewell speech at the airport. I am very glad to be going home. I am sorry we have not made more progress here. I imagine that later on, when we look back on our work here, it would appear that we have done much more than we thought at the time. The American purpose was utterly sincere, and I hope that the ministers will finally be able to bring peace to the world and to the minds of men. The Republican advisor to the Secretary, Mr. John Foster Dulles, was less patient in his farewell statement. We are not bringing back from Moscow any important agreement. However, we do bring back something worthwhile. The United States delegation, working in a nonpartisan spirit, has here hammered out specific policies which in the long run should accomplish more than agreements which would have inevitably involved much compromise. One important byproduct of the conference has been increased unity between the British, French, and ourselves. That is good, said Mr. Dulles, but it's not good enough. We all want a four-power unity. Foreign Secretary Bevin was more optimistic than the American delegates. At a press conference this afternoon, he said, "In spite of the difficulties, I am going away with the feeling that four-power unity is more strong now than it was before, because of the very frankness that has been exhibited. I believe that in the next 2 months it will be found that, after all, the Moscow conference has been one of the best contributions to build on a sound basis." This is Robert Magidoff in Moscow.
More violence in Palestine, new bombings and alleged kidnappings in the heart of Jerusalem as the underground plan for vengeance goes into action. For the story of the latest happenings, come in, John Donovan in Cairo.
Jewish extremists struck again in Palestine today. A Palestine police billet was blown up at Sirona, a suburb of Tel Aviv. The police barracks was badly damaged by the blast, and 6 British constables are missing. The 6 policemen are believed to be buried in the rubble of the building. An alarm has been sounded in the Arab city of Jaffa, and all road traffic between Jaffa and Tel Aviv has been stopped. We had a bomb scare in Cairo the other night when Secretary General Azam Pasha's house had a little ball roll in front of the doorway. The Jews of Palestine are greatly concerned over the type of representation that they will ultimately receive at the April 28th meeting of the General Assembly of the United Nations. Responsible Zionists in Palestine are anxious that the Zionist case not be associated with any proposals made by Peter Bergson of the Hebrew Committee of National Liberation. Most of the Jews I spoke to are critical of the Bergson bunch and regard them as a group of opportunists. Jewish extremists made a mistake last night when they kidnapped a young Englishman and later found out he was Jewish. They later released this man. This is John Donovan in Cairo.
There's a semblance of national unity coming in France, no matter on which side it may develop. General de Gaulle and the communists are already engaged in the preliminary skirmishes. For the up-to-the-minute report, here's Paul Archinard in Paris.
While Mr. Wallace was very busy in Paris, General de Gaulle cleared up a certain number of points in a press conference yesterday afternoon. De Gaulle repeated to that the accusation, saying that he was aiming at a dictatorship, was laughable. He said that he did not want a single party for France because a single party in other countries we know had ended with dictatorship. General de Gaulle approved the policy of President Truman to support democracies who want to stay democracies, he said. And he served notice that his new rally of the French people would certainly intervene in French elections to save France from disastrous party stripes. A leftist reporter at the General's press conference pointed out that the rally of the French people had existed right after the liberation under the leadership of the General. Do you believe that a new experience would give better results, he asked. De Gaulle responded with a list of achievements obtained by his government at the time. One of them was the nationalization of banks, coal mines, and electricity. I still believe that these nationalizations were necessary, said de Gaulle, but I do not think that their actual organization is efficient. Today, however, there are growing bread lines throughout France, and the meat shortage in large cities continues. Reconstruction is paralyzed, and finances are not good. General de Gaulle frankly admitted that he could offer no immediate solution to these problems and that they represented the job of at least one generation, which gives his enemies a chance to declare that he said nothing constructive yesterday. Nevertheless, the Communist Party has recognized a dangerous opponent in the general, and a mass rally is planned for May Day on the Place de la Concorde in Paris. This is Paul Archinard in Paris.
All Washington, official and otherwise, is waiting to get the angles from the man himself when General Marshall gets home from the Moscow conference. Let's get the latest and the inside story from Leif Eade in Washington.
This morning, with Secretary of State Marshall on the wing, the top men in Washington are anxiously awaiting his report, not only the one he'll broadcast to the nation early in the week, but the far franker story he'll tell behind closed doors. Secretary Marshall's due here tomorrow evening. The private reports that Marshall gives to administration officials and the top foreign policy men in Congress will certainly have an effect on action taken on the four Balkan treaties, the foreign relief money, and several other big items pending on the Hill. As Senator Carl Hatch says, they want the real why of the tightest diplomatic deadlock since the end of the war. Otherwise, in Washington this morning, House Republican leaders hope to get a final vote on the Interior Department budget, the one that was meat-axed in committee, 47%. They're trying to keep up a solid party front by offering Western Republicans a few more public works items. Democratic leaders are trying to break up that Republican lineup by offering the chance for more. Today, Labor Department conciliators will try once more to find some way out of this 19-day-old telephone strike, even though each side says no to everything the other side proposes. And Washington experts this morning are looking on that $100,000 loan to the telephone unions by John L. Lewis as a coy invitation to the strikers that if they find independent unionism isn't enough to win against the Bell system, why not try the United Mine Workers catch-all District 50? And speculating on the thoughts running through Bell system leadership at the possibility, sometime in the future, of facing John L. across the bargaining table. This morning, Senator Ellender says he's going to toss in a new election bill to take off all restrictions on the amount of campaign spending and make the sky the limit. And this morning, Republican Senator Ferguson calls on Congress to override the veto of the bill appointing the president's old friend, Burton K. Wheeler, as special counsel to the Senate war investigators. The president says the council's powers would be too broad. Ferguson says no broader than when Harry S. Truman was head of the committee. There could be some 1948 politics in this somewhere. This is Leif Eade in Washington.
And here are news briefs from all over the world, from Berlin. General Marshall has arrived in Berlin on his way home, and he says he's still regretful of the results of the Moscow meeting. I had hoped very much that we could get an agreement on the Austrian treaty, he says. I would not attempt to guess when that can now be achieved. Lake Success. Security officials and New York detectives are conducting a search of the United Nations Assembly Hall to prevent any incident when the special session opens next Monday. The operatives say that they expect only the best and not the worst, but they're giving the place a good going over, just in case. There's more news. I'll be back in a moment. Now here's your announcer.
This weekend, lots of us are going out to the country for a bit of sunshine and fresh air. That means crowded highways everywhere and people hurt and killed in automobile accidents. Someone in a hurry will try passing on a hill or a curve. Someone else, tired and sleepy, wanting to get home quickly, will drive too fast. The tragic results will appear in Monday morning's papers. Young people maimed for life. Husbands and wives killed. Children taken to a hospital in serious condition. Every one of us can take a hand in cutting down highway accidents by resolving to be more careful behind the wheel. We should keep within legal speed limits at all times and obey all traffic signs and signals. And remember, giving proper hand signals has saved many a life and limb. Also, check the mechanical condition of your car before taking the trip. Defective brakes, tires, or headlights are a deadly menace. When you're out in a car this weekend, be alert, be careful. The life you save thereby may be your own. And now back to the NBC newsroom.
From Hollywood, Henry Wallace, no matter what he says in Paris, will not speak at the Hollywood Bowl under the auspices of the Progressive Citizens of America. The directors of the Hollywood Bowl have decided that it cannot be used as a springboard for ideologies foreign to the majority thought at this time. Leon France. Edouard Herriot, the Arthur Vandenberg of France, because he is president of the National Assembly, is ill in a hospital. His condition, brought on by lack of treatment during the German occupation, is not considered serious. And Detroit, more than 200,000 employees of General Motors are going to get 15 cents an hour more under a new agreement reached by the union and the company. That's your World News Roundup for this morning. I'll be back at this same time tomorrow, so until then, this is Roy Porter wishing you a very good morning from the NBC Newsroom in New York.
This is NBC, the National Broadcasting Company.
When your tablets get down to four, that's the time to buy some more. Alka-Seltzer brings you Morgan Beatty and the NBC News of the World. Tonight's news, domestic, the labor battle of the century. Another big steel contract ups wages. The big price cut is still big, in name only. International, our final report from Moscow. Scientific, Dietz reports on philosophy. Baseball, Chandler versus MacPhail. Direct reports in a moment. If you had to hurry to get all the week's work cleaned up today, if you had to eat your lunch practically on the run, it's quite possible that you're feeling the effects of it right now in the form of acid indigestion. Now, when you have acid indigestion, the thing you want is real relief. So be wise. Alkalize with Alka-Seltzer. Yes, that's the thing to do for excess acid in the stomach. Alkalize. Alkalize with Alka-Seltzer. You'll like the clean, fresh taste Alka-Seltzer leaves in your mouth, but most of all, you'll like the comfortable feeling it leaves in the stomach. Now remember, you can get Alka-Seltzer at any drugstore in 30 and 60 cent size packages, and any druggist will serve you a glass of sparkling Alka-Seltzer at his soda fountain. Now, Alka-Seltzer brings you the noted commentator, author, and news reporter, Morgan Beatty.
In future years, the record will probably show that the industrial battle of the century began in the United States today in the Senate chamber. There, the forces behind a comparatively mild labor control measure set out to fight down a determined drive by a majority of senators for a hard-boiled industrial control bill, a measure with teeth in it. And Republican Senator Ives of New York, a freshman long associated with presidential possibility Tom Dewey, took the lead for a soft measure. Mr. Ives singled out Senator Ball of Minnesota for his attack. Mr. Ball has proposed a measure to prohibit unions from interfering with workers in their free choice of unions. Mr. Ives took note of Mr. Ball's charges that union organizers frequently threaten workers, and the workers in turn join unions to keep from being beaten up. Mr. Ives said the proper answer to any goon squad moves, where men go into a plant and try to disrupt work, is complete and positive police action, not punitive measures against unions in general. Now, there's nothing on the record to show that Tom Dewey and Irving Ives agree on this point, that is, a soft labor bill. But in the view of Washington insiders, Mr. Ives would think twice before he put a New York presidential candidate on the spot, particularly in view of the fact that Senator Taft of Ohio, another possible candidate, agrees with Senator Ball in principle that there ought to be teeth if there ought to be a law. Behind the scenes, the issue in the Senate tonight is whether Southern Democrats and Republicans who agree with Senators Taft and Ball can corral two-thirds of the votes in favor of a labor bill with big buck teeth in it. If they can, and they think they can, Senator Ives is leading a forlorn hope, because that means there's enough votes in Congress to override a presidential veto of a buck-tooth labor bill. On the actual industrial front, far from the halls of Congress, it's more and more apparent that labor's willing to settle for 10%, half a loaf, plus a hope that they won't get union-breaking legislation, plus another hope that prices will stay where they are. Walter Ruther's pace setters in automotive unions signed up for 10% last night and hope. Today, Weirton Steel followed suit in the game, upped the ante a little for labor. Tonight, Maryland's telephone workers signed with the Chesapeake and Potomac Telephone Company. They agreed to arbitrate all differences, including wages, and arbitration will be local. And the National Telephone Union has cut in half its demand for $12 a week more wages. That conforms to the 10% pattern cut out by the steel industry. Settlement seems very near across the map. So on a national basis, it looks like industrial peace with some inflation. And now, top news in brief. A pungent paragraph from General Marshall in Berlin, en route home. The difference of opinion, he said, among Russia and the Western allies was not increased at Moscow. It was clarified. Tonight, President Truman is heading downriver for a weekend cruise on the Williamsburg. He'll break his sunbathing to greet Secretary Marshall at the airport tomorrow, the National Airport. Then Sunday night, the President has arranged for congressional leaders of both parties to receive a direct report from the Secretary of State on his Moscow visit. The delegation will be headed by Senators Vandenberg and Barkley, if Senator Barkley gets back from his own trip abroad in time. In St. Andrews, Scotland today, Prime Minister Clement Attlee of the Labour government gave Winston Churchill a dose of the tongue-lashing Churchill usually wins. Mr. Churchill, he said, is guilty of meanness for pouring a torrent of abuse at the Labour government without offering a drop of policy. He is supporting an obsolete imperialism. And before the war, said Mr. Attlee, Mr. Churchill was the most disastrous Chancellor of the Exchequer of the century. And now for the first of our direct reports tonight, and our final report from the Moscow meeting of the foreign ministers, we hope. We try again tonight. Come in, Henry Cassidy in Moscow.
All three Western delegations to the Moscow conference are on their way home tonight, leaving behind them apologies for their failure to reach agreement on Germany or Austria, and predictions that in the long run, perhaps the conference will not have been so bad as it now seems. Secretary of State Marshall and his aides left this morning by air. The British and French delegations left tonight by train. Here is a sample of the parting statement. Marshall, I imagine as we look back in the days ahead, we shall see much more was done than we realized at the time. Bevin, four-power unity is stronger now than before. Beto breathed a sigh of relief that he could finally get back to Paris politics. Molotov has not yet commented. All day, the Moscow Hotel has been like a gigantic redeployment center for diplomats. Tonight, the empty corridors are echoing to the tread of the few of us who are left. And tomorrow, the Moscow conference will have passed into history. This is my last broadcast on the conference. This is Henry Cassidy in Moscow.
Wages and prices seem to be two parts of the same thing. Let's look tonight again to see whether the circle has been broken. Come in, W.W. Chaplin in New York.
The facts of life in America today are that the flicker of price cuts has to date become no prairie fire, and the predicted spring housing boom is a bust. Growing buyer resistance may change the picture later. First community action to cut retail prices 10% came from Newburyport, Massachusetts. Business there is still booming. Followers in other sections, however, are few, though slowly increasing. A dozen towns from coast to coast have adopted the Newburyport plan on trial, and the plan has just pushed into its first big city, being adopted for 10-day test by 1,500 Southside Chicago general merchandise stores. But on the whole, retailers still say that they cannot cut unless wholesalers come down first. Some individual manufacturers have announced cuts, but so far, industry-wide reductions affect only wine and soap. Retailer uncertainty is exemplified in Missouri. A majority of merchants in Liberty adopt the overall cut plan, but those in the Truman hometown of Independence, just across a county line, almost unanimously turn it down. Now for that predicted million homes in 1947 boom. These figures, for News of the World, come from national housing expediter Frank Creedon. The rate of houses completed has risen this year, but thousands are empty, prices too high. And in the first quarter, federal housing permits issued to start new homes numbered only 158,000, far fewer than last year. The steady downward trend extends even into April, when the big upswing should have occurred. For the week ending April 18, only 10,499 permits. Prices so high, people won't buy or build. This is W.W. Chaplin in New York.
Many years ago, Benjamin Franklin erected a road sign for the Philosophers of Science in Philadelphia. It's still there. Here's David Dietz at station KYW in Philadelphia.
Oxygen kept Uncle Sam's flyers alive as they flew through the stratosphere in World War II. As the Army Air Force grew in size, so did the demand for oxygen. American scientists went to work to develop cheaper and simpler methods of producing oxygen. And now that the war is over, these methods are opening up a new era in American industry. Dr. Earl P. Stevenson, one of the scientists who helped direct the wartime researches, told the story here in Philadelphia at today's meeting of the American Philosophical Society. Oxygen now costs $70 a ton. The new plants expect to produce it for less than $5 a ton. The first use to which low-priced oxygen will be put is the conversion of natural gas into gasoline. A $15 million plant for this purpose is now being built at Brownsville, Texas, while plans have been drawn for a $30 million one at Hugoton, Kansas. It is expected that within a few years, about one-fifth of all the gasoline used in America will come from natural gas. A second important use for cheap oxygen is in the operation of blast furnaces and open hearth furnaces. By using oxygen instead of air, the operation of these furnaces can be stepped up to turn out 30% more iron and steel. This is David Dietz in Philadelphia.
Now, a shift from pure science to baseball science. Chandler versus McPhail. From the man who broke the story first, here's Taylor Spink, publisher of the sporting news at station KSD in St. Louis.
2 years ago, on April 24th, Senator A.B. Chandler was named commissioner of baseball by unanimous vote of 16 major league club owners. The anniversary was marked by the news that Chandler, who only a short time ago suspended Leo DeRocher of Brooklyn for a year, had called another prominent baseball figure on the carpet. This time, it's the man who brought charges against Lippy Leo, Larry McPhail of the Yankees. The hearing will take place next week in the commissioner's office at Cincinnati. Chandler summoned McPhail following an interview carried on a Newark newspaper in which the Yankee president criticized the one-year suspension of DeRocher and expressed the opinion that the commissioner didn't have sufficient grounds to suspend Leo for even 5 minutes. Chandler's inquiry also will deal with charges that the Yankee president tried to stir up feeling against him among other club owners. I understand Chandler is very much displeased because McPhail keeps ignoring the fact that Larry's own charges against DeRocher were not the entire basis for the suspension of the Dodger manager, when, as a matter of fact, DeRocher's serious troubles resulted from what Chandler called a series of unpleasant incidents. This is the third clash between Chandler and McPhail. The first was last spring when the Yankee president and the commissioner differed over a rise in admission prices. And then there was a clash over another subject at a Chicago meeting in August. There is reason to believe the Yankee president will not get off with a mere reprimand after his hearing before the commissioner, unless he can prove that he did not give out the newspaper interview or that he was misquoted in his criticism of the commissioner's decision on DeRocher.
Thank you, Mr. Spink, and that's what happened in the world of sports today. Morgan Beatty will return with some more late news. Do you have something special planned for the coming weekend, maybe a party or something? Well, here's a suggestion. Just in case you may want it for relief of acid indigestion or a headache, be sure you have plenty of Alka-Seltzer on hand. You don't want to reach for that Alka-Seltzer bottle and discover that someone's used the last tablet and forgot to get some more. So buy two packages of Alka-Seltzer from your druggist instead of one, and always keep an extra package handy. You never know when you may want Alka-Seltzer, and it may be sometime late at night after the drugstore is closed. So get that extra package. For an extra package and late at night, you may thank yourself for your foresight. From coast to coast, this program will observe an 8-second pause while you make a note to get one-a-day brand multiple vitamins from your drugstore. Ready? Seconds, eight vitamins in one capsule, vitamins every normal person needs. That's what you're sure of when you supplement your meals with one-a-day brand multiple vitamin capsule every day. It's your vitamin health insurance because it helps you look well and keep well. When you buy vitamins, insist on one-a-day brand.
Now, here again is Morgan Beatty.
And here are signs of our times. Columbus, Nebraska. Does Macy's tell Gimbel's? They do in Columbus. Montgomery Ward got into the warehouse jam after a fire. No place to store incoming shipments. So Montgomery Ward tried Sears Roebuck for space. In 3 minutes, Montgomery Ward got what it wanted from Sears. New York, don't forget you commuters and air travelers, not to mention some radio listeners. The schedules are on standard time come Monday, no matter what your daylight clock says. And Secretary Marshall goes on the air Monday night, 8:30 to 9 p.m., Eastern Federal Government Standard Time. And that's the news of the world. This is Morgan Beatty speaking for Alka-Seltzer, saying goodbye from Washington.
Beginning next Monday, if your community stays on standard time, you'll hear this program 1 hour earlier. But if your community changes to daylight time, you'll hear the news of the world at the usual time. This is Tom Moore speaking.
This is NBC, the National Broadcasting Company.